The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell, and today we are talking about penises. And you did hear that correctly. My first guest today is Karen Bondar, a biologist with a twist. She's a science communicator and TV host with gigs at Scientific American, Discovery International, Earth Touch, and Science Alert. Her new web show, Wild Sex, about the evolutionary biology of sex, has amassed 1.5 million views in its first few weeks on air. Hello again, Karen. Thanks for being here.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
And we are also joined by semi-regular guest Cy Curious, a postdoctoral researcher in neuroscience. She blogs at the Cy Curious Brain at Scientific American and at Neurotic Physiology at Scientopia, where she covers the new, weird, and wonderful in neuroscience and physiology. And yes, that does mean a lot of penises. Cy, always lovely to have you here.
Thanks so much for having me on.
And John Logsdon is also back with us today. John is an evolutionary biologist at the University of Iowa, where he is associate professor of biology and director of University of Iowa Pentecrest Museums. He studies the molecular evolutionary genetics of sexual reproduction, and his current research focuses on the evolution of asexuality and is funded by grants from NIH and NSF. And you may remember John from the Semen Science episode. Welcome back, sir.
Glad to be here.
So let's get this out of the way right now. We're doing an episode on penises not because I am favoring one kind of genitalia over another, but because of the incredible, incredible diversity of penises. I apparently have enough material for an hour-long show. There are barbed penises and detachable penises and corkscrew penises and penises that resemble hands. But there is not that same level of diversity in vaginas. So why is that?
I'll jump in as the male representative on the panel. I would actually posit that although penis evolution is very interesting, part of the reason why we study it is because we can actually see it. And it's actually somewhat unclear how much evolution of internal reproductive organs of females is actually similarly elaborate. I would leave it to some future study to ask whether there's, and we know that there's a lot of fertat evolution of reproductive structures between males and females in lots of species. And so I don't know. I know that the penis evolution is interesting, but I'm not entirely certain that the premise that vaginal evolution, if you will, is not equally interesting.
So we just don't know yet because innies versus outies.
I would venture to say that, yeah, that's an extremely good point. And I'm sure there's a lot of physiological mechanisms within females that happen, sort of cryptic female choice and sort of post-sexual choice of certain kinds of sperm, things that we're not able to see. But I would also add to that as well, that in a lot of species, of course, females are always going to be the choosy sex and males have to impress them. So in some of these cases, you know, males have really elaborate structures, including, you know, all sorts of things like horns and feathers and in some cases the penis to just be crazy elaborate and, you know, the ones that are, you know, have the most pleasing, if you will, shape and form get the ladies. There's some cases where we can suggest that just based on the good old who the females are choosing, that's who's going to get laid.
I would actually agree with John as well. And I would also say that a lot of the things that we would say as being, you know, wild diversity among penises, and they are, you know, wild and massively diverse, massively, that there's also the fact that when it comes straight down to it, a penis is a sperm transfer mechanism. It is a tube. Sperm travels down the tube. Sometimes it comes on the outside, sometimes it goes down the inside. When it comes down to really, really basic mechanisms, they're all relatively the same. It's just all the extra is kind of bonus, you know?
Oh my. Are there a range of theories about penis diversity, or has science come to a consensus on why they are the way they are?
I think we have a good general framework for understanding penis diversity having to do with sexual selection and, you know, increase in male fitness and all the things around arms races and, you know, elaborations to sort of beat out the competitor. I think there's a general framework for the diversity and elaboration of external reproductive structures that really works pretty well. And they evolve quickly. I mean, that's the other thing. Sexual selection is one of those things that provides both a framework and an explanation for understanding that, you know, these things are changing incredibly rapidly. I mean, very close relatives of Drosophila species, for example, have quite different penis structures. Now that might have something to do with speciation as well. So sexual selection is involved in the process, and our understanding of how sexual selection works provides that explanation.
Anyone else?
Yeah, I would jump in there too to just reiterate that. And what I also love, the fact that there are some cases where biologists themselves are perplexed, because in some cases, the diversity of the penis doesn't really make sense to us. And the earwig is a great example of that. The earwig males that have the longest penises take the longest to have sex with a female. All of us evolutionarily thinking, you know, based on a lot of things, taking a lot of time to do your thing isn't necessarily a good thing, especially for the female. And, you know, the guys with the big members are not particularly bigger or stronger or any better. They just have bigger members, and females always choose to have sex with them. I do have a paper that the biologists conceded that yes, indeed, it seems they're just enjoying that member a whole lot more than they would a small one. So I love it when the examples of what we see in biology don't necessarily line up with what we would expect.
Those are the fun things to study in biology.
So
the exceptions,
fun.
Perhaps. Yeah.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. Today we're talking about penises with Cy Curious of the Cy Curious Brain, John Logsdon, evolutionary biologist, and Karen Bondar, creator of the Wild Sex web TV series. Okay, so let's take a look at some of these weird penises. Who wants to talk about the barnacle?
I do! The barnacle is mostly well known because it holds the world record as having the biggest penis for its size. That is not nearly as impressive as it sounds, sadly. It's not actually large, it's just 8 times the size of the barnacle. And this is because when you are attached to a rock, as a barnacle is attached to a rock or a whale or a boat or whatever barnacles are attached to, you have to let your penis do the walking, right? And so the penis gets to go around and do its penis thing at great length, one might say. But one of the most interesting things I actually find about the barnacle penis, other than its excellent size choice, is that barnacle penises actually vary in size between individuals, not only as a result of sexual selection, but actually also as a result of things like where the barnacle lives. You don't want that thing snapping off, but they can actually change their penis shape and size to suit local water conditions. So if they're in like a really, really heavy wave zone where they're getting smashed around a lot, they're going to have short, fat penises, relatively. Whereas if they live in an area that has relatively soft currents and nothing too dangerous, they're going to have a much longer, thinner penis.
Okay, but let's look at that evolutionarily. Aren't there disadvantages to having, you know, your penis be the same thing that facilitates your mobility?
They do much better taking in food, remaining where they are. You also have to keep in mind that these barnacles are growing in large colonies. It's not like they have to go miles adrift in search of a lovely lady. She's usually right next door, or maybe 3 barnacles over. You know, they're experts at the girl next door thing. They just send the penis over. It may not make necessarily sense, but it's a good evolutionary adaptation for where they're stuck.
And also there could be other factors that are at work here. The reproductive strategy could at some point in the evolutionary history of barnacles have been less important than, for example, surviving and being able to get enough food. So these guys are extremely susceptible to predation when they're very small. So it makes a lot of sense for them to grow and live in these large groups. We have to sort of keep in mind it may not be that it evolved that way for the penis, but that could be a byproduct of where it was. Yeah.
Okay, next up, the leopard slug.
When leopard slugs are going to court, they find a lovely little tree to climb, to slither up together, and then they suspend themselves down on this lovely hanging hammock kind of contraption, and their penises come out and intertwine with each other. You have to remember that slugs are hermaphroditic, as are barnacles. These guys have both male and female parts, so they will both take out their penises and intertwine them around each other and begin to fertilize each other. So if you see this happening, you will see 2 slugs hanging around, and then you will actually see this slimy ball that's underneath them. And if you're wondering what that is, that's the penises. Oftentimes, they will get so tied up with each other, literally, that one of them will end up nibbling off the penis of the other to break free. Once one of their penises has been nibbled off, they won't regrow it. So that one will be exclusively a female from then on. You know, it's a lovely story.
I can feel the romance. I don't know about you guys.
John's like, no. Well, yes, for sure.
That's a nuptial gift as well. At the same time.
Yes, indeed.
Something and, borrowed.
I feel it incumbent upon me to point out also that they're extruding these penises from the sides of their heads. This
yes,
is not
point.
At the one end. It's at the it's at the head end.
Gotta love those gastropods. They got it all going on. The anus sits right there on top of the... Yeah,
you know, they can be boys. They can be girls. They can be both.
I am never going to make it through this show. Let's move on to a different species. House cats.
Meow.
I guess, is that your cue, John?
No, I was being the comic relief.
A lot of felines, house cats included, but also tigers, lions, they're, if you think of those spiky things that you drive over when you go into like the duty-free store, and then you can't drive back over them the wrong way or your tires will get popped on your car. There's spikes on the male penis that are like this. So when the penis slides into the vagina, no problem. But as he pulls out, and this is for house cats, like I said, all sorts of felines, when he pulls out, these spikes come out. And this is very painful for the females, and she will oftentimes vocalize that, and her body language will suggest that, yes, that is very painful. It's thought that that's actually something that might induce ovulation, this painful response. And so that's why biologists think that these spikes happen in cats, because that's actually how ovulation happens. And therefore, if you match up ovulation with copulation, certainly your chances of paternity and fathering the next generation are awfully high, much higher.
So that extends to all of the felines?
Yes, I believe it does.
The spine thing is actually a general thing. So inducing ovulation is just but one thing. I mean, lots of organisms use spines. There's some controversy about if you see spines on a penis, what that actually means. Could be that it's being used as a – not only to assure paternity, to sort of stay in. The tire analogy is great, Karen. But also to sort of think about scraping out the ejaculate of a previous suitor, as it were.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not certain that's the case in cats, but in general, spiny penises are actually a general feature across lots of different organisms.
The human ladies are lucky.
Well, you know, there's a whole condom industry based on bumpy things. And I was just going to point out that, in fact, it turns out many primates actually have bumps or...
Yeah, chimps sort of have penile spines.
Right.
Do they?
At least bumps. And there's been some suggestion that humans have lost those. And there's a suggestion about a year ago in a paper about a certain gene that was, you know, the gene was deleted and it was related to human evolution. And us human boys have lost our penile spines. I guess it built an industry for certain kinds of condoms.
So you mentioned the idea of scraping out the ejaculate of previous partners. From what I understand, that is actually sort of a controversial idea, is it not?
It depends on the species.
Yeah, indeed.
In many, many species, females mate with many males. And it's very common for males to have strategies to either prevent other males from mating with her or to have some kind of a very yucky way of making sure his is the only one. And scraping is certainly one of those options.
There is some controversy in human penis shape. So, you know, the human penis has this bulbous head. And there was one hypothesis that the bulbous head of the penis was used to scoop out the semen from other males that might have been there before you, if you're unlucky enough to have seconds. But there's also another hypothesis which suggests that the large head of the male penis might be better used, in fact, for plunging rather than for scooping. And then there's a third hypothesis that
which
says
are not mutually exclusive.
Crap. Yeah. And then
sorry, what was
hypothesis
the third
hypothesis says they don't work.
So next, let's...
You didn't have humans on your list, and we're getting it in there.
I thought they were the least interesting species, honestly. But, for example, in comparison with the anglerfish, we got nothing.
Actually, no, the anglerfish males are very, very sad. They're like
little
buckets.
Oh, I think they're great!
They're brave, and, well, it's a sad story. Zai, you're such a good storyteller.
When they were first hunting down the elusive anglerfish, which, as you may know, is rather deep-sea-dwelling, they noticed that they tended to only find females. Because they're predators, they don't school. They're solitary. So the problem was, like, you know, they kept coming up with all these females, and they were like, well, okay, is this, like, a single-sex species? Where are the males? You know, how do they find each other to mate? What is going on? And then they noticed that all of these anglerfish females appeared to be infected with these small little bulbous parasites. And they were like, what are these little parasites? Those are not parasites. Those are the sad anglerfish men. The sad anglerfish, or perhaps the happy anglerfish male, which has achieved the pinnacle of male perfection. In the end, he is just a pair of gonads. And that's all he is.
That's very poignant because really, in many species, humans included, all we need from you is one molecule. Sorry, John. All we need from you is the sperm. That's it. And so the anglerfish is taking this to such a drastic level. Eventually, the male is just simply absorbed by the female. And he's, you know, he's a parasite for a while, but then he's just gone.
Males are just sperm-producing things at a basic level.
Oh, that's
it is, it is also sad because for the anglerfish, it's never just one parasite. The purpose of the male anglerfish is to find female anglerfish. And so when you find these female anglerfish, they often have tons of males, you know, stuck onto them, literally fused down to the level of the blood vessel. They actually like have an enzyme that digests their skin and digests her skin so that they're like fused together. There's tons of them. So there's like, you know, a whole bunch of them on this female anglerfish. And they release their sperm in response to hormones that they can sense in the female's bloodstream. And so not only does this poor anglerfish male end up as nothing but a pair of gonads, he is in competition with other sad, lonely pairs of gonads.
Yes.
All indeed. Hanging around, hoping desperately if gonads can hope.
The boy anglerfish, I mean, so the females are 20 centimeters and the males are 3 centimeters. So there's a ratio, 20 to 3. Think about these organisms called spoonworms. So spoonworms, the female is 200,000 times bigger than the male.
Wow.
So we're talking about a little tiny, tiny, tiny organism. And it turns out he attaches right near the reproductive tract of the female. So talk about not being able to find the males. I mean, literally, this little teeny tiny organism is really only there to make sperm, period.
Yeah, he can't have much of an ecology outside of just contributing sperm. Isn't that interesting?
Yep.
On the other hand, you always feel pretty good about achieving your goal in life.
You're tuned in to Skeptically Speaking, and we will be right back with many more penises after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com. Or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and we are spending an entire episode talking about penises, just because. I'm joined by evolutionary biologist John Logsdon, Karen Bondar, creator of the web show Wild Sex, and Cy Curious of the Cy Curious Brain at Scientific American. Now, we have not even scratched the surface of the penis, and I really should not have said that. That actually came out. Okay, anyway.
I get to say ouch.
Yeah, sorry. Sorry. Okay, so let's talk about the bed bug. Let's go there. Ooh, that's why. Go ahead.
Attaboy, John.
So bed bugs, as it turns out, like more organisms than we might have thought, practice a kind of curious sexual mechanism called traumatic insemination. And it is what you think it is. It's pretty traumatic. It turns out that penises in bed bugs and other organisms that do this mechanism of traumatic insemination insert not in the vagina, but elsewhere in the body so that the ejaculate, the sperm, can have a better chance of making it in the reproductive tract of those organisms. They're not bed bugs. That's basically all they do. And so the idea is to sort of avoid the whole female choice stuff, that cryptic female choice that might be going on. You know, just avoid the vagina altogether and figure out how to get the sperm to go directly to the eggs. And that's what they do. And so it turns out that the male literally penetrates the body cavity of the female to inseminate her in order to achieve higher reproductive success. The female is kind of hurting, but had it not worked, it would not have persisted. And so bed bugs are pretty strange. Bat bugs are other organisms that do this as well, but bed bugs are kind of the classic example.
Trying to soften the blow of being stabbed with a really pointy penis. Bed bugs in particular have actually evolved an organ. Female bed bugs, it's called the mesospermalegi.
Indeed.
Yes, and this is usually where the sperm is injected into. It's actually an organ in the body cavity of the female. It's thought that this keeps down the inflammation and wounding associated with being traumatically inseminated.
Yeah, it's interesting you see this as a progression, because bed bugs have been obviously reproducing via traumatic insemination for a long, long periods of time. And so, yes, you see this evolution of a secondary structure in the female. So the original spermatheque, or whatever structure was originally accepting the sperm in the species, they went through a phase where there was obviously nothing. And now secondarily, they have evolved another kind of cavity. You see other kinds of spiders that do this, and other bugs that haven't necessarily gotten to a point, or perhaps won't get to a point where they are evolving a secondary structure to accept the sperm. But it's very interesting. And there are all sorts of pointed and just very scary sounding penis-like structures in the insect world.
This gets back to the spines, and so there's the bean beetle does this, where the penis actually does inseminate through a vagina, if you will, but does it in a way that is traumatic, that brings the sperm even closer. And so there's, as Karen said, there are sort of evolutionary process going on here, and some organisms, the females have evolved responses to that process as well. And so traumatic insemination is sort of a general thing that may involve through the body, or may have started by sort of standard sex that has gotten a little bit rougher.
Okay, let's talk about something happier, the echidna.
So echidnas are monotremes, as you might have known. And what's interesting about the echidna is, like other monotremes, they have a bifurcated penis. That means it divides into two. But the echidna is not content with just bifurcation, no. No, the echidna has four heads to the penis. Because why do two when you can do four, right? And interestingly, the penis of the echidna is actually only used for the passage of semen. It actually pees out of a cloaca, which is elsewhere, as opposed to using the same tube. But what's particularly really interesting about the echidna penis is that it is capable of one-sided ejaculation.
That's what I wanted to talk about.
Yeah, using only half the penis in it. And there's video of this, and it'll change your life. So when it ejaculates through half the penis, the other half actually retracts two heads. So it's just two heads at a time. And that is because the female's vagina is as bifurcated as the male's penis is. So you need the two at a time.
So do they choose which side? How do they do that?
I don't know if they choose it consciously. I believe they alternate.
That's interesting. I don't know about the echidna, but I know in a lot of snakes and other reptiles, this is the case. And especially for a snake, what happens is there's going to be, you know, these massive orgies. And you, like you said, Desiree, you just don't know which side you're going to end up on. It just helps to have some on either side. So you just use whichever one is closest to a vaginal opening.
Seriously, I'm just having giggle fits in the corner. Don't mind me. Okay, so how about the Argonaut octopus? Because this is fascinating.
This is like one of my very favorite examples, because I have an episode about this in Wild Sex where we talk about the scariest thing in the ocean, and it's not a great white shark. It is a detachable swimming penis. And that is literally what the Argonaut, or the paper nautilus, has. And it was originally thought by biologists to be a separate organism. I mean, sure, you see something swimming around, you assume that it is something other than just a detachable swimming penis. But no, it turns out that this will go and find the female, attach itself into the correct place, and there you have it, friends. Grow another one next year.
How does it do that? How does it find the vagina?
I'm going to guess, John, maybe you can jump in there. I'm going to guess pheromonal.
I'm pheromonally. <giggling. laughs>
I don't know. There's no GPS.
My understanding was chemosensing, but I would love to see someone do a study with like chemosensory, like of females in like one corner and like a whole bunch of detachable swimming penises in the other and just watch them go.
I want to do that.
Well, I'm wondering the rate of accuracy. Like, does it just, like, does it find what it's looking for? Or is it going to sort of stick on anything?
This is a use it and lose it situation. It's no good if it misses. So you got to figure it must be pretty good.
In general, with these organisms, I mean, I'm glad Karen knows about these things, but in general for octopi, they basically have a spermatophore and they basically hand it to the female, right? So they just, they have a pile of sperm and they provide it to the female on one of their tentacles. So this may just be an extension of that.
Do they have to take them to dinner first?
I know, right? It's like a nice little package, like a Christmas present.
Here, have some spermatheca.
But I guess he doesn't get any sex, though, which is, I guess, a little sad for him. There's no sex. It's just sperm.
He doesn't have to take her to dinner, then.
Yeah. He doesn't.
Okay, let's move back to mammals. How about, do you want to do the elephant or the kangaroo? Your choice.
Oh, elephants. This is, you know, I love this because you can't rape an elephant. The females have something called a penile clitoris, and this happens in hyenas as well. It's very difficult to actually sex an elephant just by looking at it, because this penile clitoris hangs down, in the nether regions, just like a penis would. And imagine trying to put a penis into another penis. Okay, this is the scenario with the penile clitoris. So what has to happen is kind of like inside outing a sock. A female has to draw this thing into her body, and then it's inside outed, and then the male is able to put his penis in there. Remarkable adaptation. And then socially, what sort of follows up on this is elephants and hyenas are among the two solely matriarchal societies in the mammal world. And I find this endlessly fascinating because males have no sexual power. Females, therefore, have all the social power. Love it.
I will point out that according to my sources, elephant penises approximately are 5 feet long.
Your sources?
When they're fully erect?
I assume that's an erect. So this is a great – I have to plug this book. It's kind of a funny book, but it's actually got a bunch of great biology in it. It's actually called How Animals Have Sex, A Guide to the Reproductive Habits of Creatures Great and Small by David Strom. And it's a little coffee table book, but it's fantastic. It's great natural history, and most of the things that I've double-checked are actually pretty darn good.
This is Skeptically Speaking. Today we're talking about penises with Karen Bondar, creator of the Wild Sex Web Show, Cy Curious of the Cy Curious Brain at Scientific American, and John Logsdon, evolutionary biologist. So, you know, we've been talking about all the different penises and all the different ways that species can have sex, but I can't help but notice that some penises don't seem to be very much fun for the lady of the species, or the man of the species, actually. But why, evolutionarily speaking, do some penises provide pleasure to the partner and some do the exact opposite of that?
If pleasure is evolutionarily beneficial, then they might do that. If it's not, they probably won't. You know, evolution doesn't care about pleasure per se. Evolution cares about the number of offspring that are produced by a particular event. And females and males have different goals in general. And so therein lies conflict. In some organisms, there's less conflict. In some organisms, there's more conflict. And organisms for which sex is pleasurable, and sex should probably be pleasurable at some sense because we need to do it to persist.
Well, but then look at those darn bed bugs.
This is what I'm talking about.
I have also wondered about fish that do like external fertilization, you know, where the female lays a whole pile of eggs and the male like goes and releases his sperm over the eggs. Like, are they both going, oh, yes, yes, pump that sperm into the water. That's right. I mean, are they?
I doubt it.
I would doubt it too.
There are, you know, there are differences there too. Like males have extreme competition with other males. For example, when you're needing to throw your sperm onto a separate, or, you know, a certain pile of eggs. So there will be evolutionary adaptations with respect to how they do that. And the most successful ones, of course, will be the ones to father the next generation. But I think, you know, generally speaking, when a sexual system is a polygynous one, where a female is mating with a lot of males, you will have males competing with each other. And in this case, you will see, because of the intense male competition, females rarely have a choice. And there's rape, and there's pain, and there's death. And it's not, you know, it's not this romance, lovely, happy scenario that we humans are lucky to enjoy. So, yeah, sorry about that.
Well, actually,
you
brought up something that's really important. So what's up with all the rape?
Yeah, that's it. That's it in a nutshell right there. It's really, males and females often have completely conflicting views about what they need. If the female can use, or if she gets filled up, for example, and a lot of these insects especially can store sperm, if she's filled up by one or two copulations, she doesn't need any more. And she therefore should be spending her time taking care of offspring or finding food or avoiding predators. But any male who hasn't had a chance to put his sperm into her little sperm bank is going to try to get her is going to try to do that. So oftentimes these directly conflicting views result in a lot of violence.
You know, in the case of dolphins, they're putting it wherever they can find a place to put it. Mm-hmm. Is that rape? I think the things that I've seen, at least with regard to homosexual behavior, which is widespread amongst lots of different animals, is simply something that's going on that's behavioral, that simply happens, whether or not it's a reproductive event or not. It's quite widely distributed. So, is it calling it rape is putting a value judgment on it, which for our species, of course, it's important, but for other species, I don't know.
Yeah, good point.
I would agree with John there. I mean, many biologists prefer the term forced copulation instead, because, you know, in humans, rape is not about reproduction, it's about power. And it's a much more loaded term, whereas in, you know, other animals, you know, you can't really ask them how they feel about it.
You know, there are so many studies that we do extrapolate different species to human behavior. So Can we learn anything about humans via the rapiness of different species? Or is that one of those areas where humans are attempting to justify their actions with pseudoscience, as it were?
That's a really big question. And I think we have to, first of all, keep in mind that when we're looking at animals that we are, you know, very, very distantly, evolutionarily separated from, there is a lot of violence. But, you know, we have to also bring this to our, you know, it's hard to look at some of our closest relatives, like chimpanzees, for example, that are very sexually violent and coercive with one another. I don't think we can necessarily say that rape doesn't happen with a chimpanzee, because these guys are pretty much just like us. I don't know. Maybe that's going to get me in trouble saying that. I don't know.
I mean, this gets into the area somewhat controversial called evolutionary psychology.
Indeed.
I think we have to be careful about making inferences in human behavior. We have to be careful from, you know, comparisons to other species. But I actually think that it can be quite informative. We can't use it as a license for bad behavior. You know, it's in our genes or whatever. But I think it is informative to think about human behavior. And, you know, I think there's a lot of promise for making comparisons. In preparing for this, I ended up looking up a fair bit of stuff on human evolution. And I came across this paper called Sexual Coercion and Forced In-Pair Copulation as Sperm Competition Tactics in Humans. So the idea is, you know, if humans are in a bonded relationship, married couple or whatever, why would there be, in that context, why would there be a report of forced copulation, as it were? In other words, sort of rape within the marriage, if you will. And And so they put it in this context of sort of thinking about how rape evolved. But one of the things that they talk about here in turn, they did some surveys and such, and you take it with a grain of salt. But the idea, the premise is to think about sort of what might be some benefits, some evolutionary benefits of this. And one of the things was mate retention, sort of female guarding behavior. And so it turns out that males would do this more frequently if they thought that their mate was somehow, or if there was reason to believe that their mate was somehow had infidelity. And so it doesn't excuse it. But the point is that there are evolutionary things going on in us as animals, as evolutionary products, that we can learn about, why behaviors might exist, based on, sort of potentially useful evolutionary arguments. And I'm not endorsing one or the other, but I'm just saying that, evolutionary arguments are general usually. And so they can provide some insight into thinking about both biology and behavior.
Yeah, that's really interesting, John. You bring up a lot of really interesting points. And when you take a look at both chimps and bonobos, to which we are both equally related, you have on one side a violent system, on the other side a very friendly system. But, for the most part, in other primates, gorillas, orangutans, it's very violent. So there's a lot of evolution, I guess you could say, that has gone into that. But then, I don't know, closer you get up to sort of bonobos and humans, we've got to keep in mind where those differences are. Yeah. And that it's a very tough topic to talk about without ruffling a lot of feathers, so to speak.
Well, there are assumptions about that we bring to the table as 21st century human beings that, our species is monogamous and all this sort of thing, yes, that may or may not be true, that
absolutely.
We actually have a lot of evolutionary underpinnings that might not be directly correlated with where we are now or where many of us may or may not be. And so I think that evolutionary psychology in comparison to other organisms, it's pretty clear from penis size and testicle size in humans that we're probably not ancestrally monogamous.
Yeah, agreed.
Among other things. And so it doesn't mean that monogamy isn't natural. It just means that we have different evolutionary underpinnings that we bring to bear from our ancestors.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and we're talking about penises and penis-related things. Stay tuned, and we'll be right back after these messages.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we team up with Scientific American magazine to learn more about the technologies profiled in their World-Changing Ideas feature article. We talk to SIAM editors and writers about cutting-edge research. From artificial life forms to new ways to measure sustainability, these technologies just might shape our collective future. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. Today's penis panel guests are Cy Curious of the Cy Curious Brain at Scientific American, John Logsdon, evolutionary biologist, and Karen Bondar, host of the web show Wild Sex. Okay, back to weird animal penis facts.
First, can I ask if the penis panel gets a t-shirt?
I hope so.
I'm so making those, and you know I am.
I think we need one.
There's a quite famous, for our listeners out there, poster that one can find on the internet called Penises of the Animal Kingdom. Fantastic visual.
Can FYI. You get it framed?
I'm sure you can.
I'm crying.
Seen in many biologists' closets.
And nowhere else.
Okay, let's start with the Western Harvest Mouse, because from what I understand, he has the longest penis comparatively.
Sigh, wasn't that you who was talking?
No, I was going to have John take over, because it's not so much the longest penis as he has the longest penis bone, the longest baculum.
Relative to size, I mean, I was going to go with this walrus, which is actually the longest penis bone, including a fossil that has a length of 4 feet. So we should talk about what a baculum is. So it's a bone that is in the penis of many mammals, but not all. Unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on your perspective, not in humans. although some primates have them. And so, and the idea is that it's there to presumably to provide an additional support for erection and for copulation. And in general, carnivores and rodents, they're widespread. But as I said, fairly widespread in other organisms.
Oh, so John, I have to ask about the baculum. So but the when it assists in erection and ejaculation, do some species have bacula and they don't have other erectile mechanisms? Like they don't have lymph or blood or something else to inflate the penis? They just have a baculum that like flips up? Or is there always something else?
Apparently, the answer is that some organisms can do it without all of the blood and other accoutrement that that organisms like humans do.
Okay.
So in other words, if you've got the accoutrement to get an erection without a bone, maybe you can lose it.
Yeah, I don't believe that it's the only. I think it's always sort of accoutrement, as John said.
Yeah. Plus, I mean, can you imagine? There's all these horrible medical case studies of poor men who have broken their tunica albuginea, which is a part of the penis that's it's the firm outer ridge firm outer covering of the organ that fills with blood. And when you break it, it's really pretty horrible. And I can only imagine how bad it would be if humans had bacula, because then we'd be reading horrible case studies of the broken bacula.
How do you break that thing on the male penis? Just out of curiosity.
Various methods I've seen have been traumatic sex. accidents.
Don't try putting it into our body cavity.
Biking accidents, unfortunately. accidental puncture, accidentally shooting yourself with a shotgun. There was something about tennis wire, but I don't know if that actually broke it.
Okay, moving on. Let's talk about the bees. That isn't much better, but let's do it.
Ouch. Bees are great. The endophallus, the detachable endophallus. The bees are another wonderful example of being able to control, perhaps, the future sexual conquests of your mate. So these worker bees, they insert their endophallus or bee penis into the queen, and it simply breaks off. And I believe they do die, don't they?
Yep,
and then the next bee that comes along grabs the endophallus of the previous one, and as John was saying earlier, does a little bit of scraping and inserts his endophallus.
And then he dies.
And so it goes.
And really, you know, the drone bee, the male bee is a drone. You know, they're almost as sad as the anglerfish in their way. You know, these dudes are so sad they are haploid. Like, they don't even have a full set of their own genes. Because that's not the point. They're a big flying snap-off penis, and that's all there is to them.
Good point.
And that's an interesting point about the sort of the social structure of bees or other eusocial insects. Is this, you know, you kind of sometimes think about these things as being one total organism, because some of them are just for reproduction and some of them are just for gathering food and things like that. So yeah, it's a very, very interesting case.
Let's do a cheery one, super cheery one. The lesser water boatman. Yeah.
So that's not cheery.
It's kind of cheery.
No, the lesser water boatman is awesome.
Thank you, Sai.
The lesser water boatman is not the biggest penis. He's not the smallest penis. He's not even the stiffest penis. He is the loudest penis, because that's what matters. You thought size mattered? No, it's sound. This guy's great. He rubs his penis along his abdomen to create this horrifying noise. At least it would be a horrifying noise if you actually listened to it in the air. This is called, I think it's pronounced stridulation, this movement of the penis along the abdomen. It's like, have you ever heard washboard music? Where somebody, like, rubs something along a washboard and you hear that, like, ripping noise?
Right.
Like that. But it doesn't sound quite like that. But it is so loud. It is one of the loudest sounds in the animal kingdom. For example, the blue whale is thought to, I think it's the blue whale, is thought to be the loudest with 188 decibels. The lesser water boatman is 1/1,000,000,000th the size, and he produces almost 100 decibels worth of sound.
Wow.
It's like going to a rock concert filled with penis.
aren't all rock concerts filled with penis?
Bam.
So why?
Depends on who you're going to see.
Why did they do? Why? Why, Sai?
Well, that's interesting. It's thought that they make this horrific noise, which is not so loud when you're hearing it in the air. It's in the water, which is why it's so loud, because water doesn't carry sound very well. So you can hear it in the air, though, when they're at the bottom of the river going at it. It's thought that this call helps to, you know, court and call females. But it's also, I mean, it's an interesting adaptation because, yeah, they're making this loud sound and the females are getting all hot and bothered, but they're also alerting every other predator out there saying, Hey guys, I'm over here with my penis, right here. Come and get me. So it's very interesting to show the lengths to which animals will go to, you know, get the ladies in.
You think he's really saying, hey guys?
Probably to the predators.
Okay, so I want to get to this because we are steadily running out of time and there is so much penis. It's overwhelming. So I do want to talk about, we mentioned earlier the idea of extrapolating sort of studies on different species to humans. So what about, I read an article that referred to a study on penis size and monogamy. Is there a link between the two? And can we actually say that has anything to do with humans?
We absolutely can. I think if we look at a couple of our closest relatives, if we, for example, take the gorillas, the chimpanzees, and the humans. Humans actually have the longest penis of any primate. So, you know, human boys can be very proud of those long penises. Your testicles.
I should like to note, though, that's only on average the longest.
Oh, you're so mean. your poor husband. No, I'm just kidding.
No. Everybody
in Lake Wobegon is above average.
Oh.
So comparatively to something like a chimpanzee, we have male humans have very small testicles. And this can be related to the fact that chimpanzees are still promiscuous maters. They do need a lot more sperm than, generally speaking, the monogamous humans do. Now, gorillas are tiny. The erect gorilla, gorilla is maybe like 1.5 centimeters, fully erect. He's tiny and his testicles are like little raisins. And this basically is sort of evolution saying, well, because you are so muscular and so huge and you have these jaws and you have these muscles and nobody is going to cross you, you don't really need to have a big penis because basically you have a harem of females and that's it. Nobody's going to hurt you.
When the harem is the big deal, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
But I just want to be clear about this. So it's not that penis size causes monogamy or that monogamy causes penis size. There's just a correlation, correct?
Yeah. The causal length is a long-term evolutionary trajectory. If a species is monogamous, a major way of thinking about things in evolution is use it or lose it. If you don't need to invest in some structure, some thing, some activity in order to gain, you know, the benefits, then why invest in it? Why put the resources into bigger testicles, bigger penis, et cetera, if you're going to get the same outcome in terms of reproductive success without it? And so evolution works in that way, is that it's not going to those things presumably are somewhat costly to have, you know, again, big testicles, big penis. If you don't need them, then why would they be maintained? Why wouldn't those resources then go into some other physiological structure in the organism? And so that's a general principle. So in a sense, it's causative at some general level. It's not causative kind of in the immediate.
Right.
And so it provides an explanation as a cause, if you will.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and today we are all about the penises. My guests are evolutionary biologist John Logsdon, Karen Bondar, host of the Wild Sex web series, and Sai Curious of the Sai Curious Brain at Scientific American. Okay, we have very, very little time left, but I really need to know this. I sent you guys this before the show. Is it true that polar bear penises are shrinking?
there was a study that came out in 2006 that was looking at polar bear penises, and not because scientists are horrible voyeurs, though you never know. And it was looking, it showed that polar bear genitalia, it's not just the penises, it's the testicles, the penis, and the female's ovaries were actually shrinking. And of course, when people think of polar bears, the first thing they think of is the ice caps are melting and OMG is climate change, but actually it's not. It appears to be a problem with pollutants, particularly pollutants in the oceans that mimic hormones. Like one of the ones that everyone's heard of is BPA, which is an estrogen mimetic in humans. Things like that, that mimic hormones in polar bears. And the problem is not that it's in the seawater. The problem is that these hormones are very lipophilic. It means that they're attracted to things like fats. And so they build up in the fat of the polar bear's favorite snack, the seal. And so the bears eat the seals, and the seals are full of hormones, and then bear penises shrink. And this is a real problem, actually, because, you know, not only climate change, etc., but also because polar bears are actually some of the worst sex havers in the terrestrial mammal kingdom.
What does that mean?
They don't mate a lot. They have very low reproductive success in general. So shrinking testes is not going to help.
Like kicking a guy while he's down, kind of.
Right where it hurts.
No, and I mean, sex, you bring a lot of good points there, especially about how in sort of apex predators or large, you know, the predators at the top of the food chain, we're seeing this all over the world as far as having toxins build up in the body. This is an extremely unfortunate example. Not so much, you know, humans care a lot more when it's about the fish that we're eating and it could be deleterious to our health. This is obviously something that could be extremely bad for the polar bear in terms of its sexual health. It's just, yeah, and it's a common trend.
Will someone think of the poor polar bear penis?
I will.
How they're looking
ever.
Down and they're so disappointed.
So my Googling of this revealed an article entitled "Polar Bear Dick Size is Apocalypse's Most Recent Casualty." So
that was the greatest one.
There are at least some people paying attention to it.
Okay, so we said at the start of the show that female genitalia maybe doesn't outwardly exhibit the spectacular diversity that male genitalia does, but that does not mean that we shouldn't talk about a little bit of it. We've covered penises, taken advantage of all the penis. So now I want to talk about duck vaginas, because they are the most amazing thing that I have ever heard of in my entire life.
They are pretty amazing. So the corkscrew crazy shape of the duck vagina is something that, of course, has evolved together with the very powerful male erection. So what happens with ducks is that males have these spiral penises that don't get erect before they are inserted into the female, much like any other mammal is. What happens with ducks is it's all kind of in one big sproing motion. And this thing basically is very, very forceful. And it comes out very, very quickly. And yeah, inserts right into this spiral cavity of this vagina. And it's thought that that's got to do a lot with cryptic female choice. So there are cases in the animal kingdom where females have the last laugh. So if you've ever seen ducks reproducing, you're walking along a little pond or a lake and you see them reproducing, it's very traumatic. I mean, the first time I saw duck sex, I threw rocks at the males because it's really hard to watch. It is. It's essentially game rape. And the female has the last laugh because she, by her positioning during sex, she can make the sperm of a certain suitor more liable to reach her ovaries. And so it's a wonderful example of evolution. Wow. Yeah, we love this.
But what's interesting is that the ancestral condition of most birds is to not have male appendages at all, but in fact to have just holes that bump against one another, cloacae, as it were. And so this is a sort of very specific group of birds that have this sort of specific adaptation that as Karen says, in the end, the female wins because she gets to choose somehow physiologically which male gets to win.
One of the interesting things about duck penises is that unlike some systems, like, for example, most mammals, where the sperm goes along the inside in this tube inside the penis, the duck penis, like other penises, including, say, the ostrich, the sperm actually goes on the outside. So the twisting corkscrew is also a channel for the sperm to, like, wind its way around on the outside into the turning, twisty female vagina.
It's like a big twisty trough.
How about, you mentioned this earlier, the female hyena. I really want people to get a sense of how amazing this is.
All I can say is ouch.
Why, John?
I mean, giving birth essentially through, you know, that small cavity.
Yeah, the death rates actually of female hyenas during birth are, I think, higher than in other related species
the penile clitoris. I mean, it is right. True. Imagine giving birth through a penis. That's true. Interesting. But there's so much sexual power. So they have the sexual power. They just don't have the birthing power. Obviously, evolutionarily, it's working for them, but it certainly is a lot more difficult.
So why is a penile clitoris the evolutionary response? How would that occur?
That's a tough one. It's tough to say how that would have originally come about, whether it was in response to extreme violence or whether it was in response to, that's a really great question. I'm not sure that we have the answer to that. John, do you have anything to add to that?
I don't, but it was brought up earlier that there's this relationship between matriarchal societies and, you know, and having large clitorises in elephants and in I have never really thought about the question. So worthy investigation if nobody else hasn't done it already.
Yeah, the social aspect, I would say, would probably have come after the event of this physiological barrier to males. Why the physiological barrier to males happened in the first place is very rare. I don't know of any other animals that have this. That's really worthy of thought. Maybe I'll go postdoc on that or something.
Sounds like a wild sex episode to me.
I know. Oh, we have that one. We have it. We went to the elephant reserve.
So now I'm wondering, you said in matriarchal societies that they have bigger clitorises. So then that would mean the bonobos as well. And for anybody who doesn't know about the bonobo clitoris, it is something. And you should probably just go listen to my interview with Vanessa Woods. She's the author of Bonobo Handshake. And that's exactly what you think it means. So do you think that follows then?
I don't in this example. Okay. But I do think that like bonobos are extremely wonderful sexual society. So males have large testicles and large penises. Females have engorged clitorises. And I think that it's because they are just using them, like John said, use it or lose it. And they're a very sexual society. In the case of the penile clitoris, this is actually a barrier to males. So, I want to say that in the bonobo clitoris and, of course, in the human female clitoris, this is a pleasure thing. Whereas in the case of the elephants and the hyenas, it's more of a preventative thing.
Is there any way that they could feel pleasure from that?
Oh, I believe so. In the bonobos? Absolutely.
Oh, no, I mean in the hyenas.
Oh, yeah. Good question. I doubt it.
Well, on that depressing note, do we have any other, before we completely and utterly run out of time, any last words about penises?
Well, I would like to say that everybody loves the penis. It's a great topic because people always have a lot of curiosity. People want to hear about it. People want to know about it. People are interested about the diversity of it. I mean, I guess when all is said and done, we are a sexual society. And you don't get hate mail over penises. You just don't.
I actually always thought it was just because they were so funny looking.
John?
I can't beat any of that.
And on that note, we are out of time. You guys, that was a weird and weird hour. You can find Cy Curious, Karen Bondar, and John Logsdon at the links on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, please do click the links to Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, where you can keep up with show news, and to iTunes, where you can subscribe to the program, listen to past episodes, or leave a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, 'cause we're skeptically speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is produced and distributed by Suburban Panic Media. Our studio assistants are Helen Cavillion and Chelsea Butler. Ryan Bromsgrove is our studio technician. The show is edited by K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by A.O.K. And I'm your host, Desiree Schell. This episode was edited by lead technician Ryan Bromsgrove.